Hey everybody, Brian Alvarez here with a brand new intro to the interview that you're about to hear with David Shoemaker, aka The Masked Man, as well as Josh Nason. We're talking David's new book, The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Professional Wrestling. Now, the interview you're about to hear doesn't sound very good, and I just want to apologize to David and Josh and all of you listening right now. I didn't even realize until after I listened to the interview back how bad it sounded. And in the 8 years that I've been doing shows here on the website, this has never happened before. And I still, right now, have no idea what happened. I heard it sounded horrible. I came back and recorded something else, and it still sounded horrible. And I kind of, you know, as most people do when they've got a hardware issue, I jiggled some cords, I plugged some stuff back in, still sounded bad. So I went and I rebooted everything. I rebooted the mixer, I rebooted the computer, I rebooted everything here on this desk, and then I did another test, and now it sounds fine. So I have absolutely no idea what went wrong. I'm very sorry it sounds so bad. I guess the best that I can say, as I noted on Twitter, is sit back and just imagine you're listening to a 1950s AM radio interview. Because that's pretty much what it sounds like. A lot of crackling, a lot of hissing. Particularly infuriating because it was a great interview. And again, I want to thank and apologize to David Shoemaker, the Masked Man, as well as Josh Nason. And hopefully something like this never happens again. I have learned a valuable lesson about doing a sound check before I go on the air. And again, I don't know why it happened, but it seems to sound fine now. So hopefully it's something that won't happen again. But once again, I apologize. Hopefully everybody enjoys the interview. And again, as I note during the show, I do recommend the book. It's called The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Professional Wrestling. David Shoemaker, a.k.a. The Masked Man. So head up to Amazon.com or your local bookseller and check it out. But enough. Let's get to the interview. David Shoemaker talking his new book, The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Professional Wrestling. How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez and Josh Nason. Here on Figure 4 Daily, it is November 6, 2013, here at figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. We are joined today by David Shoemaker, who is the author of the brand new book, The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Professional Wrestling, which is available, I presume, everywhere right now, wherever everywhere might be in 2013. And David, how you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me.
No problem. You obviously have done a lot of writing over the years, and the thing here on the other side of your book, I believe, mentions you've been writing about wrestling since, I think it says 2009, but clearly, especially from reading the book, I mean, you've been a fan for a long, long time, and it appears to me that, are you in your mid to late 30s?
Yeah, you got me right.
Yeah, you are exactly like me and a bunch of people listening to this right now. You started watching in the mid-80s and probably grew up right during the Monday Night Wars. And now here you are trying to figure out what the hell's going on in 2013. Would that be correct?
Yeah, a lot of time trying to figure that out these days, I guess. But yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, so I got Jerry Lawler's Memphis Wrestling for all of my childhood, and I guess it came on right before or right after WWF on Saturdays, and yeah, that was pretty formative for me.
Well, let's talk a little bit about prior to Grantland and ESPN and such. I mean, what were you doing prior to getting into pro wrestling journalism, if you want to call it that?
Well, I've been working in the book publishing industry for a long time. So I guess it's, a matter of time before I have a book that comes out. Right. But I was a book editor for a long time and doing some design work too. And just sort of fell backwards into this opportunity to write about wrestling. I was a guy who was working at Deadspin, basically demanded that I write about wrestling for him because I'd been sending him links of funny stuff and they'd been getting good traffic. And so I started doing it, and that became my column, Dead Wrestler of the Week, which was, titled in such a way as to offend as many people possible. And that led to Grantland. It's a pretty straight line from there.
So you were sending a guy links and he decided, I must have this man write about wrestling.
Exactly. Well, they were doing good traffic for him. So he's like, we need original wrestling content. And we went back and forth a little bit, and that was right then when, all of our childhood idols were dying. And it just seemed like a really you know, sad place to be as a wrestling fan. So I started, like, you know, we called the column Dead Wrestler of the Week, but aside from the very end of each piece, they were profiles of these guys and celebrations of their life and, you know, lots of funny YouTube videos and stuff. And that kind of took off. And that sort of, you know, directed the way that I've been writing since then. It's a pretty cool gig as long as you look for the good and the bad together, you know?
Did you, I mean, when you, these links that you sent him, I mean, did you send a link and then kind of write up a little explanation of what was going on? Or did you just like, here's the YouTube embed code. And then he was like, oh, that'll be a great writer.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would write stuff to him, you know,
I
mean,
I see.
Like sometimes they would just be links to something else, but for the most part, I would have to explain what was going on. And then, you know, they would either lift that copy or they would just, you know, rewrite it themselves, but he could tell that I could write. And when I initially pitched this, you know, the Dead Wrestler thing to him, we were thinking like, you know, 500 word pieces, just little, like, it could have been like a chart of like finishing moves and hometown and that kind of stuff. But it ended up pretty quickly evolving into long essays. And, you know, I guess that's kind of what I come to be known for, as being like the really long-winded wrestling writer. So
when you, well, you're nothing on Dave, I got to tell you that.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's absolutely true.
Now when you hear Dead Wrestler of the Week, I mean, at first you're just kind of like, oh, that's nice. Dead Wrestler of the Week. But when you actually read the columns, as you noted, I mean, they are essentially tributes to these guys. And a lot of the guys are guys that, it was kind of, I don't know if it's funny, but in the book, I mean, every bio that you include in the book is in fact about a dead wrestler, except one. You had to do the chapter about Ultimate Warrior, who I guess kind of, I mean, when I read it, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but when I read it, the hook was kind of like people rumored that the real Warrior was dead and a new one replaced him, because of course he came back in the mid 90s and, you know, whatever he was doing, he wasn't doing then. So he looked completely different.
Right.
But, you know, I read it and I was kind of like, okay, that's a clever idea to explain why he's in the book, but really he just wanted to write about the Ultimate Warrior because you grew up a huge fan. Is that right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think I said before that one of the highlights of my childhood was the Survivor Series when it was the Warrior and Kerry Von Erich and the Road Warriors all on the same team. And I noticed that, I looked back and I was like, man, I really like those guys with giant muscles. And I had no idea. I didn't really realize it at the time. I guess we all did. But yeah, I did really want to write about the Ultimate Warrior, you know, and, you know, my publisher was excited for me to write about the Ultimate Warrior because, despite, you know, the fact that there are a lot of wrestlers who have passed on, a lot of the biggest stars from our childhood have managed to hang on. So yeah, I mean, but, you know, but the point of the essay is that, you know, that chapter is about how he didn't really die, but so many people thought he died. And, you know, it's when you're considering all the different deaths in pro wrestling, it's nice to take a look at somebody who didn't actually die.
You know, it's funny with the Warrior. I mean, I was, man, 12, 13, 14, actually maybe younger. I was probably about 12, actually, now that I think about it. And, I was playing Shirts and Skins basketball, and I was a skin, and I was completely embarrassed because I was so skinny. And I was a wrestling fan at the time, and I always remember that as I got older, people would rail on Hogan and all these guys, and, you know, they're telling these kids to take their vitamins and exercise, but they're really on steroids. What a terrible message to send. This is so horrible. And I always remember thinking, wait a second, I was 11, and I started working out because of the Ultimate Warrior. I didn't know that he was on steroids. I never took steroids in my life, but I did start working out because of this big jacked up dude. So I always kind of thought it was funny that everybody accused, you know, it's so terrible for these guys to be on all this stuff and be talking about how the kids should exercise. I mean, to me, it was a great message. I didn't know any better.
Oh, no. I mean, he was running to the ring. It's a great cardiovascular influence there, too. I know. I totally agree. He was definitely bigger than any of us are ever going to get by natural means, but you're right, totally good influence. I think there are a lot of wrestling fans that fall into that category.
So let's talk about the Grantland experience so far. Did you start right from the launch, or was it like a few months after, or how did that?
No, I was there from the very beginning. Yeah.
Okay, so obviously Bill Simmons, for those that know who Bill Simmons is, and I assume most of our listeners do, was very much like us, a huge, you know, wrestling fan of the Attitude Era. Monday Night Wars and all that. How did that relationship come together for you with Grantland?
I think Dan Fearman, who's the kind of editor-in-chief of the site now, reached out to me when they were just starting up, and we were talking back and forth about different things for me to do, and then Simmons got looped in, and he knew who I was from the Deadspin stuff, and he was just like, all right, well, you know, he has to cover contemporary wrestling. I think they were still trying to figure out exactly the angle for, you know, wrestling on the site, but it's really, you know, it's the ideal place for me, and I got super lucky to be a part of it, because it's a sports and pop culture site, we don't really have to answer the question of whether or not it fits. You know, I mean, ESPN's not going to cover wrestling, and you know, it's not, like, TV places aren't going to cover wrestling, but, you know, a sports and pop culture site is a perfect place for it. Then he told me to start covering the current product, and I had been watching, but you know, I started watching real religiously and getting on Twitter and doing all that kind of stuff, and I don't know. It's been an incredible experience. You really have to kind of pay a whole lot of attention when it's your job, you know, and it makes it more fun to watch that way, I feel like.
So when with Grantland, obviously it's a spinoff of ESPN. It doesn't have any ESPN branding on it, but obviously, you know, you're an ESPN employee and so on. Was it, I don't say there's any hesitation or, you know, some people just, they can't seem to make that split of it. It's a different brand of ESPN, and that, again, you alluded to it, you know, it like, why are they writing about pro wrestling? Did you get any of that sense at first as the site was kind of like trying to find where it was in the world?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I get that on just about everything I write. You know, whenever they throw one of my pieces up on the Grantland Facebook page, inevitably, like, the first comment is, what the hell is this doing here? But, you know, it's just one of those things you learn to live with, you know? I mean, like, I always joke that, like, you know, the wrestling fans, you know, like, the one thing the wrestling fans always have to deal with, the most hated part of it, is when those idiots come up to you and say, you know, it's fake, right? As if you had no idea.
I dealt with that all last night, actually. I had friends over.
Yeah, exactly. You get it all the time. But it's that same, you know, it's that same thing now with the, like, what is this doing here? It's like, man, if you're going to waste time commenting on a wrestling story instead of just ignoring it, then I don't know why I'm, like, offending you in this way. But, you know, it's the weird netherworld that wrestling exists in, and as part of what makes it so awesome, right? I mean, it's just always sort of an irritant anytime wrestling content pops up on the internet. But that's why we love it.
And it's definitely been a unique relationship between, you know, a traditional sports outlets and pro wrestling. It seems like, yeah, everyone can remember when, you know, Hulk Hogan is on Sports Illustrated. And anytime, like, a mainstream publication covers wrestling, it seems like it's almost an event rather than a, you know, common occurrence. And one thing with your coverage on Grantland, I think it kind of really came full circle when I looked at ESPN.com one day, and I saw a big picture of CM Punk there right on the cover of ESPN.com along with all these other, you know, stars. It was treated like a story. And that was obviously when he was a huge star, and I believe you had written that piece. I mean, that kind of just seemed to play right perfectly at the right time. One of the biggest kind of crossover stars that that wrestling has seen in years, and the fact you have such a huge audience and a platform with Grantland and ESPN.com seemed to be a perfect storm, if you will.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm incredibly lucky to be there, not just because the other writers there are so good that it makes me, you know, look like I'm part of good company, but also, yeah, I mean, when the moment comes that, you know, the mainstream wants to take a little peek into the wrestling world, then, you know, Simmons will make sure that I'm there and ready to give it to him. But, you know, I think we're in a cool spot with wrestling right now, where it's like, you know, the whole world has gotten so ironic on all these, you know, every blog has this incredibly ironic voice that you can just sort of, like, acknowledge that you're a wrestling fan now, and it's not as weird, and it's not as incompatible with a place like ESPN as it might have been like 5 years ago.
Now the columns and the book, I'm not going to mention anyone's name currently because it just seems kind of like weird. But do you kind of feel that you've got a shelf life as a writer, because the people that are dying right now are all of the big names of the 80s and early 90s, or the ones that have passed away already? I mean, I guess the question is, as morbid as it sounds, do you think people are going to care as much when the 2000 generation starts to pass away just because of the state of wrestling it is today?
Wow, that's a really good question. You know, I mean, I think that the reason why I cared enough to start writing was because you know, there was that stretch where it just really seemed like dire and morbid, and guys were just like, every time you turned around, another guy that you watched growing up is dying. I think it would have been much less significant if it's just people aging out, you know. But you know, I'd like to think that they'll care. But the bigger issue for me wasn't just that the guys were dying like in real time. I mean, when I started writing about it, I discovered that what was much more interesting to me was the sort of the distance between these like invincible superheroes that I grew up watching on TV and the real lives behind the scenes of these guys who ended up being, you know, just as mortal as you or I. It's a weird way to interact with your idols. But I, you know, that really intrigued me.
You know, what's interesting is, I was watching the ECW Monster Mash from like 2007.
Yeah.
And they're all big, you know, Great Khali, Big Daddy V, Big Show Kane, all really, really big guys. And Vinny and I are watching this match and we were just like, they're all alive still. And it was kind of like, it was a weird realization because we watched so much old stuff. And part of the thing when you watch old stuff, I mean, even stuff from the early 2000s, sometimes you're kind of like, well, that guy's dead. That guy's dead. That guy's dead. And sometimes it's really like, it's kind of really creepy. But the fact that these four guys were all alive, and I really look at, you know, there are a lot of people that say a lot of things about the WWE wellness policy and such. But you know what? There's a lot less people dying right now. A lot less people dying right now. So it is making a difference. And maybe, you know, maybe 10 years from now, it's not going to be so morbid. There will be a guy dying here and there, just like anybody else dies in any other form of entertainment, and not this big glut of people dying all the time.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, one of the things that you'll hear, I mean, that I hear a lot when I talk to people about this, is people in the industry will say that, you know, the wrestlers today are more likely to be in their hotel rooms playing Xbox after an event than in the hotel bar, which is the only place where you used to be. And I think part of that is just a generational thing, but I think the bigger thing is that, you know, guys, a lot of the big stars now, I mean, I would say the majority of the stars now are guys that grew up like you and me wanting, like loving wrestling, and they dreamed of being wrestlers. And so they lived through the same thing that we did. Like, they saw these guys die, and to a certain extent, that makes the industry look like self-correcting. You know, I'm not saying that, like, Mr. Perfect dying or whoever made CM Punk become straight edge, but, you know, you realize they saw firsthand what happens if you don't take care of yourself the right way, and I think that's going to be a big difference for the next generation.
Interested to get your take on what you where you think the wrestling business is today from a, I guess, from a health standpoint in terms of fan interest, not just from the mainstream people that pop in and out, but also the people that actually consume the product. I know it's something that on this site is talked about a lot, and sometimes it's you know, from our generation, I'm 35 myself, and I'm with that group that feels like we're kind of like alienated at times from the product, but there's certain things that can bring us back in and nod and so on. I'm wondering what your take is as someone in this that segment, but also someone that covers the current sport, the current state of it. What do you think that the health of it is at this stage?
I think it's really interesting. I mean, I think it's basically healthy. You know, ratings and stuff have been pretty consistent over a long period of time, and they want, you know, they keep trying to find new ways to expand the audience. And, you know, it's just one of those things where it's hard to know if in this day and age you can even expand anything significantly. You know, I mean, there's just too many channels on right now, too many other things to do. But I think, you know, they're in a weird spot because on the one hand, they're trying to expand. They're trying to, you know, market towards kids to kind of get that next generation of fans in. But then, you know, they're talking about doing like a subscription-based WWE Network, which I think could be super cool. But that's the sort of thing that only works for the hardcore fans, right? I mean, it's like, that's like, you're looking for the fans who are like the you know, the Fish fans that travel all around the world with them and watch them play like concert after concert. Like, those are the fans that you need to make a network work, especially if it's subscription-based. So who knows, you know, maybe the disenfranchised fans like you and me will you know, have another moment in the sun coming up because they're going to need us to be, you know, their core audience. And you can make a lot of money if you just keep mining the core audience, but they just got to figure out how to keep the kids watching so that they can be us in 20 years.
Yeah, and there's one thing of that, and from my perspective, you know, I think there's I think our world of content, and fill as much space as you can in on the internet, on TV, and every medium that you can. I think it's hurt, you know, I think it's hurt the UFC, which we talk about a lot here, but I think it's hurt WWE a lot. And the reason I say that is, you know, every single week there is, what, a minimum of six fresh hours when you count Raw, SmackDown, and main event. That's not counting, you know, the online stuff with superstars and then the, you know, the pay-per-view weeks and things like that. I mean, that's a lot of, I mean, we look at the era that we grew up in that really kind of drew us in from the 80s through the 90s, 2000s, whatever. There was just less of it to take in. And I think it's just that really, like, it dilutes the product because you're just stretching it out over 6 hours a week. And I think, you know, you look at these great TV shows, and I know WWE likes to compare themselves to episodic TV or whatever it is. I mean, I couldn't do 6 hours of new Breaking Bad content every single week. That 1 hour just felt like it was so tight and so good. And I think from a lot of other shows like that, the less is more. The problem is that they're trying to, you know, fill all these deals. Again, with the network you alluded to, I just wonder if the way to get some of us back is to do less. But I don't know if you can put that genie back in the bottle again.
Well, yeah, I mean, putting the genie back in the bottle is actually something that I've been toying with writing about, but in a more metaphorical sense. But yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it's really hard. What they're doing is really hard. You know, I mean, back in the, you know, people always say, why can't wrestling be more like it was before? And this is the number one reason. You know, I mean, Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant feuded for years. I mean, it was like literally for like a calendar year, this was the storyline. And you know, like those old, the glory days of the NWA, you know, you go back to that like TBS show, and Ric Flair would come out and just like cut a promo on all of the faces in the locker room one by one, because he was going to be facing any number of them at house shows over the course of the next couple of weeks or whatever. And that would take up 10 minutes of the TV show. And you know, he and Dusty feuded for how, you know, however long that was, for years. Right. You just can't stretch it out anymore because there's just too many events, you know, and fans will, you know, complain that things move too quickly, but they would be complaining if they were moving any more slowly in this day and age. I mean, I know that there's a happy medium that they can strike somewhere, but yeah, it's just way too much content, and I don't know that you can reduce it, but it would be great if they could figure out a way to make it all seem really significant without making it seem mandatory. I don't know if that makes any sense. But yeah, I mean, listen, the creators of Breaking Bad, you said you couldn't watch 6 hours of Breaking Bad. The creators of Breaking Bad couldn't do 6 hours of Breaking Bad. So
right.
I don't, you know, WWE, I think, does a really good job of, you know, producing quality with what they have. But man, it's too much for anybody to watch, let alone to put together, I feel like.
The Triple H interview was in the news recently. For those of you that remember this was the one where Hunter buried Wade Keller for something that it turns out Wade Keller never said. I think that's how most people remember this on the site, because Dave talked about this.
And that's totally fair.
About an hour. Yeah. So because of course, for those of you unaware, David Shoemaker is the Masked Man. I think most of you put that together, but if you didn't, if you've ever read anything by the Masked Man, that's David here. So in doing this interview, I mean, what kind of vibe did you get from Hunter? In the sense that, I don't know. I always kind of get that, I don't even know who to really compare him to. I always just kind of feel like he's really good at selling himself and making you believe he's sincere. Some people I believe, like Hulk Hogan, I don't know. I don't even know how to say this. I'll just ask you, what were your thoughts on Hunter?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you interview somebody and you can just, the thing you think is like he was really on, you know, like he was really engaged, he was really like kind of in character, like he was whatever. Hunter was like the opposite of that. I don't want to say he was off, but like I got that interview. I mean, one of the reasons why I got it was because the Grantland office in LA was like 40 feet away from the hotel he was staying at. And, you know, I had gone to the PR guys, and I was like, really, the only guy I'm interested in interviewing is Triple H right now. I mean, it's like, that's what my readers would love to see. And I just got, you know, kind of the lucky break that it was, like, easy for him to get to me. And he just walked over, you know, in just, like, jeans he was really laid back and really chilled. And I felt like, you know, I've said it a million times. Anytime you talk to a wrestler, you're getting worked, right? I mean, that's who they are. That's part of the job. But that said, I felt like he was pretty open and honest, and he was definitely more human than I was expecting him to be.
I've never talked to Hunter. I've talked to Kevin Nash, and they're good buddies. And the thing with Kevin Nash is, Kevin Nash is really good at making you feel like you're his buddy. And it's not just me. I mean, you could talk to anybody in wrestling. Anybody in wrestling that knows Kevin Nash will tell you the same thing. He's really good at just making you feel like he's your buddy. And he may not necessarily be telling the truth, or you may know that, okay, he doesn't really believe this, but he's so good at being your buddy that you're just kind of like, all right, Kevin, great. And I don't know, I just kind of, like I said, I've never talked to Hunter, but I sort of get that impression that, you know, he may have walked over there and thought, oh God, this is some Grantland creep and I got to give this interview. But during the interview, I mean, you're his buddy, you know, he's just a nice guy.
No, I mean, I think that's totally true on some level. I mean, on the other hand, you know, Triple H has there's so many like negative rumors surrounding him backstage that I'm guessing not everybody feels like his buddy back there.
Well, that's probably true.
So you know, I mean, in some ways that's definitely true. Like it was his, like he was there to like get good PR for himself and for WWE by talking to me. I mean, that's obvious. And there and you know, it's silly to think he wasn't trying to make it better for him, you know, by acting nice or by doing whatever he was doing. But, you know, I made it really clear to him and to the PR guy up front that just like, you know, if there's anything you can't talk about, you know, you don't want to talk about, just tell me. I mean, just and we'll skip it, because I don't want us to be BSing each other. I was like, this is just like, no one's going to enjoy it if you're just like, you know, working me throughout this whole thing. Now, you know, obviously he was working me on some level, like I said, but yeah, I mean, it was a weird experience. It was definitely weird to be kind of to feel like he was being that open. But you know, you'll never know. And you know, the best we can do is to sort of like, you know, try to suss out whether or not he was being honest. We'll maybe look back in 5 years and see what we think.
Yeah. I wonder from, you know, my gut instinct, I feel like he's going to be for the business more potentially destructive than positive. And the reason I say that is, I felt like a couple of years ago when it became clear that he was going to be the person to kind of take over from Vince in terms of the, not that it's the face, but just really kind of just the heartbeat of WWE, that he, you know, I think people felt for a little while that there could be change. I think, you know, the developmental center in Florida is a big thing, obviously. And little things like that, I think people thought that, you know, there might be change coming. But I get this sense just from the interviews he does, even the, you know, the in-character, on-screen interviews, which a lot of people assume is the same thing as you would say backstage, the stuff that you refer to, everything else, that really when, you know, Vince finally relinquishes control, that it's just going to be this another 40 years of the same stuff that we have that people got frustrated with and kind of drove people out and alienating people and all that stuff. I was wondering what your thought is on that.
Yeah, I mean, I totally take what you're saying, and I think that there's probably a lot of truth to that. But I think the good things that he's done so far with the developmental program, with, you know, signings of certain guys, and really just, you know, no matter what you think about indie wrestling vis-a-vis like wrestlers coming over, I think he's done a really good job with that stuff, and I think that will probably lead to, you know, better talent coming into WWE in the future, and that's gonna, you know, that's a significant thing. It's not a small thing. First of all, Vince is never gonna relinquish control. I think we're gonna probably have a really awkward like three last years of his life where it's just like, you know, he's dictating, you know, he's like scrawling notes with a piece of paper on, you know, backstage and telling everybody what to do. But there's not going to be anybody that replaces Vince. And the vibe I get from Triple H is that he's not particularly interested in being that guy. He's kind of interested in the other stuff, you know? I mean, he's interested in, like, a very specific set of developmental, of, like, wrestling history, that sort of thing. If I had to guess, I would guess that between him and Stephanie, there's still going to be the need for a third head running WWE after Vince goes.
Okay. Well, let's get to the book. Brian has finished it. I am about a third of the way through it, and I'm going to tell you, so I think people kind of understand where I am in terms of my my wrestling fandom. One of the alienated, still keep interested with the product. Again, from that Attitude Era, and I used to watch, you know, ECW, USWA, Smoky Mountain, everything I get my hands on back in the day, I used to watch I love the book. From what I've read so far, I'm positive it's going to be the rest of the way in. What I like about it is it's written in a way that is not dumbed down for wrestling fans. I think a lot of people assume that anyone that watches wrestling is like of a lower ilk. You know what I mean? They have that persona about them, right? But just the words that you use, I think it's a very smartly written book. And in the history, especially the beginning, I think it's great for people that are really interested in the history aspects, but aren't maybe interested in getting every single minute detail. I think you hit enough of it where people get detailed information enough, but also that you're able to not stay at a certain era too long, and that you're kind of moving along and people get a nice foundation and as it goes. I was interested in going through the book, especially, you know, you reference a lot of historical stuff from some of the old New York papers and so on. You obviously, you know, when you're doing a project like this, you're going to learn a lot of stuff. What key things did you take away and learn that you never thought, you know, I can't believe I learned this, or I'm so glad I researched this, or so on and so forth?
Well, yeah, a lot of that stuff a lot of that historical stuff was kind of revelatory. I mean, there would be articles or that I would hear referenced. You know, someone's like, oh, back when so-and-so said this in the paper. But yeah, going back and getting my hands on it and really finding out that, like, you know, there were some really cool, interesting things written in the New Yorker and in Collier's and in all kinds of newspapers about the wrestling industry back as early as the, you know, 20s and 30s and stuff like that. And, you know, they were always kind of winking around the fact that it was fake. You know, I mean, it wasn't just, you know, when Vince McMahon Jr. decided to call it sports entertainment that people started getting that idea. And actually, yeah, one of the most revelatory things for me personally was finding, you know, people always say that Vince Sr. would be rolling over in his grave if he saw Vince McMahon calling it sports entertainment. But Vince Sr. was telling the Washington papers basically that it was fake in the 50s. So I don't know how quickly he would have rolled over, you know.
Right, right. And that was something actually it was talked about in one of our shows earlier this week is the, you know, about that kind of history and when do people know it was fake. And you definitely, I mean, that's a thread in those first few chapters or so is that a lot of people knew, you know, and it was kind of this almost like an arrangement of sorts that people just didn't pull back behind the curtain, that they knew and that it was fine because it was treated as an entertainment form like anything else.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the deal that wrestling, you know, the wrestling promoters and wrestlers that they make with the fans, right? We just kind of interact as if it's real. And that you know, affects how we cheer and how we boo, and that affects how they, you know, put on the show. You know, but the kayfabe thing, you know, I think was important because, I mean, a lot of people did believe it was real. I don't want to say that they didn't, but I think, you know, the important thing is that the tacit agreement that we're acting like it's real, that we're, you know, interacting with each other as if it's real. And, you know, just because those guys would, you know, would keep up kayfabe, that was an extension of that. That doesn't mean that they thought it was real or that they thought you thought it was real. But yeah, I mean, and that's sort of the coolest thing about wrestling. I mean, it's just like how that sort of like reality and unreality kind of interplay throughout history.
So obviously you had a lot, I mean, potentially you could have written about anything when it comes to wrestling and the history. And it could be, I can imagine sitting down to kind of plot this out, you know, it could be a pretty daunting task. How did you go about choosing where to start, how to, you know, how to structure the book and so on? How did that process work?
Well, I started off with the concept. I mean, it spun out of the Dead Wrestler of the Week column, so I started out with the concept of each chapter being about a wrestler who had passed on. And then when I started talking to publishers about it, it was clear they wanted sort of a bigger book. And so I kind of, you know, just sat down and tried to figure out how I could make what I had into kind of a more comprehensive history. And so the answer became, you know, break it up by different eras, which I just sort of like, you know, arbitrarily established, although some of them are pretty well, you know, pretty well codified. And so each era, you know, gets a big introductory essay that describes the time. And then each chapter is about a specific wrestler, but it kind of delves more deeply into the surrounding wrestling world than I had maybe planned initially. So yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of where it came. And then based on my editor's kind of comments and reactions, I added chapters, added, you know, certain sorts of people, because every wrestler, I kind of wanted to stand for something greater. Like there's a chapter on SD Jones because there had to be a jobber in the book, you know? Mm-hmm. And then there's little sidebars about just like certain subjects that he was more interested in. Like, you know, there's a thing about royalty in wrestling and race in wrestling and all that kind of stuff throughout the book.
Geopolitics in wrestling. The funniest chapter heading I've ever seen.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's sort of like one of those weird weird ongoing stories that when you start putting it together, and also, you know, I mean, listen, the wrestling world's way too big to cover in even 400 pages, you know, I mean, there's, especially during the territorial era, you know, there were what, 50, 60, like, centers of gravity going on at the same time, and it would be impossible to really do justice to all of that stuff. But, you know, I would just kind of keep a notebook of the stuff when I was writing the book of names or ideas that I had to get in there. And then sort of at the end, you kind of like find ways to put them back in. And that's what, like, the geopolitics thing just sort of emerged out of the ether, because I was just like, wow, like, all of these guys are like foreign villains or like foreign nationals. And it's a really important, you know, it's a really important thing in wrestling history that just keeps happening over and over again, that we're like going to war by proxy in the wrestling ring.
You know, one of the things that I really liked about the book is the number one thing in wrestling books, it was extremely accurate. I know when you read a lot of books, you like on the first page, you're like, oh my God, there's this and there's this. And what I liked was not just the accuracy of it, but there's a lot of stupid stuff on the internet.
Yeah.
And you actually touched on a lot of the stupid stuff on the internet and noted that often you will see on the internet, blah, 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 but this is what really happened.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, like you said, and like Josh said, I mean, you're writing a bio of Miss Elizabeth that's 3 pages long. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
And you can't go into every single solitary detail. But you did a great job. You had 3 pages to write about Miss Elizabeth. All right, here's a story. Here's the most important facts, and none of them are wrong. So to me, it was like it was a really good book for if you're like a wrestling fan. It's like a good little reference book. It's a good book to read. It's got a great history from beginning to end. It's just like, here it is, here it is, here it is. You want to know what happened? Here's a story. But it's also a great book for somebody who is not like a big wrestling fan. You know, there are people that they're just interested in this weird thing about pro wrestling and they want to know something about it. And there's a lot of books out there. And if you just want to, if you've got someone who's open to learning a little bit about pro wrestling, but they're not really a pro wrestling fan, but they're kind of a little bit intrigued by it, perfect book for that person, because it's going to tell them everything they need to know about pro wrestling in, I don't know how many pages it is, but let's see here, you know, 384 pages. You'll pretty much get a good look at pro wrestling. And if you never want to know anything about pro wrestling again, fine. I mean, you've got a good look at what the story is in 384 pages. So I just thought you did an excellent job on it.
Well, thanks, man. That means a lot. You know, I'm sure that there's going to be errors that people are going to find in the book, but you know, that's part of the hardest thing about the book was figuring out what was true. And a lot of that just kind of came down to judgment calls, you know, like we were talking before about talking to Triple H and how when you talk to a wrestler, you're always getting worked. Well, like every bit of wrestling history that you find on the internet or anywhere else is affected by this weird sort of half kayfabe that the guys carry into their real lives, even now that people know it's fake. And you hear a story one time you hear a story 5 times and you'll have 5 totally different versions of it. So, you know, I did a lot of work to sort of sorting through all that and hopefully discerning what was most true of the situations. But yeah, thank you so much. I mean, that really means a lot that you would say that. I write for guys who are a little bit, you know, who are as big as fans as I am, but also for guys who might not have been paying that much attention over the past 10 years. And I hope that everybody gets a kick out of the book.
Now, last question before we get into some plugs here, you're obviously still doing columns and writing.
Mm-hmm.
Any future books? I mean, obviously this one just came out, and I know that when I wrote Death of WCW, it was 10 years before I tackled another book project because the first one nearly killed me. I don't know if you had the same experience, but
yeah.
I was not looking at another book immediately. But have you got any ideas of maybe down the road you'd like to do a book on this or that?
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple of ideas. I mean, my experience is probably really similar to yours. By the end of it, I was down to like 1.5 friends, and you know, it was just beating me up every time I tried to sit down and write more about it. But yeah, I mean, I have a couple of ideas, but it, you know, a lot of it's going to depend on what goes on with this book and sort of just the way the wrestling world goes. You know, I mean, I'm not quite sure if I know what the book that needs to be written and needs to be read by people is. So I guess I'll have to figure that out before too long.
the book, which is available right now, I believe. I have a copy in my hand. The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Professional Wrestling, David Shoemaker, The Masked Man. If you Google any of this, I'm sure it'll come up. It's on Amazon.com, I'm sure, and Barnes & Noble. And find booksellers everywhere if they still exist. There aren't very many left in this town. But obviously you can get it online, and I'd presume a Kindle version as well. And a very, very good book. I really do recommend this book to everybody. And I want to give you a chance, David, to get some plugs out, Grantland ESPN, your Twitter, whatever you'd like to get out there. Now is your opportunity.
Yeah, well, you can find my stuff on Grantland.com. And I don't know when this is going up, but I have there's an excerpt from the book that's going up on Wednesday that's you can check out. It's the Race and Wrestling chapter, which is, you know, just about the craziest thing in there. And yeah, you can check me out on Twitter at AKA The Masked Man and find everything I write basically through there.
The book, once again, The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Professional Wrestling. Check it out. And David, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today, and Josh, of course, for helping set this up. And best of luck with everything. And of course, thanks.
Man. Thanks so much for having me on.
No problem. And of course, thanks everybody for listening. We got a lot of shows coming up today. There's UFC, obviously, so Dave will be on. I'll be on with Conan on his show later on today. So tons of stuff. Check out the front page for more. And I believe Hall of Fame issue is coming up today as well. So check it out, and we shall talk to you again after a while.